set behind, I need to post a solution, well, after today, two solution sets, and some lecture material. So I've had some other stuff I had to do this week, so I'll try to catch up this week. And among the things that I'm trying to do is to look at where we are, figure out where we're going to break the material, and send you information on what material will be on the next. So, any questions about that? Okay. So last time we started talking about this strange thing that we call center of mass coordinates. And center of mass coordinates are particularly useful when you have extended objects or systems of objects because, as I'll prove to you in a little while, the pieces that are part of the system, they may have forces on one another, but that all cancels out in the end. So the whole system will actually move in response to an external force. And you can understand how the system as a whole moves by understanding center of mass, looking at things in the center of mass coordinate system. So you can imagine two different cases, one where the parts that you're considering are discrete, and you can describe each of the pieces by their individual vector. Or you can imagine a continuous object of some form, any shape you'd like, and you can think of this object as being made up of an infinite number of little masses, each of which exists at some vector r, and the density may vary. The amount of mass in some differential little volume, dv, is going to be rho dv. Okay? So you can then think of this as sort of your discrete system, if you will, but instead of doing a discrete sum, you have to do an integral because you're summing over all these little differential pieces. The reason that this is so useful is here you have individual masses. They may vary in mass. They may have different mass densities, but you may think of them as discrete masses. Here, everything could be changing continuously, so you can't just say that this is rho times v, where v is the whole volume, because rho may be changing. So you have to multiply rho by what it is for every little differential volume. So this is what drives you to have to worry about the integral. I'm going to do a case in a little while where we're going to use an integral, and hope that I can give you a sense of how that kind of thing actually works. We will be doing some of it in this class, and we'll be doing a lot of it in Physics 114. So I would like you to work on doing that and not just throw your hands up and say, oh, it's an integral. I'm not going to do that. Because I know it's a little bit frustrating when we first get started. At any rate, in the discrete case, the center of mass coordinates in each coordinate is the mass-weighted average position. So you basically sum up all the various bits and you divide, weighted by their individual masses, and you divide it by the total mass. And you do that in each coordinate system, so it's a three-dimensional thing. If you're only considering a one-dimensional problem, then you only need to worry about one of those. So in the continuous case, where you're not doing a discrete sum, but you are adding together all these infinite little pieces, then the sums in the limit where the mass is differential, you work out the integral. Okay? And the bottom integral is often basically trivial. It's just the mass of the object, and very often you're just given mass. You don't really have to work out that integral. Sometimes you do. It depends on what it is. But this dm, is usually you think of it as rho dv, and then what you're usually given is something like how this mass density rho changes with volume. So you do a volume integral over whatever it is. Okay, so that's sort of how it looks from a theoretical point of view. I hope it'll be a little bit more clear when we do an actual example right now. So So let's suppose we'd like to find the center of mass of a baseball bat. I guess it's sort of timing. If you think about the baseball bat, you could, by symmetry, tell me that I know that the center of mass has to be along the axis of the bat. So in terms of y and z, you already have your answer, in a sense, from the symmetry of the problem. But it isn't at all obvious where the center of mass is going to be along the x. So in this problem, it just boils down to finding the center of mass position along the x coordinate for this baseball bat if we lay it on the x axis with x equals 0 at one, the thin end of the bat. So it's a continuous problem, so we need to use the continuous form of the center of mass coordinate system that we were talking about. In this particular problem, what you're given is a formula for the linear mass density. So you're very used to thinking about volume mass densities on average from chemistry and such. So you take whatever the mass is and divide it by the volume, which means it gives you a density. And you can also have area mass densities and linear mass densities. And what I mean by a linear mass density is imagine that I take a saw and I slice this bat into lots of little pieces, maybe dx thick. And then I ask, what is the mass per unit length for those little dx's, and how does it vary with distance? So the linear mass density is usually given by lambda, and it's quite literally just the amount of mass you have per unit length. So it's not a mass per volume. Okay? So if we were doing areas, so if I have a surface and I broke it into little dA's, or differential areas, then I could take a mass per unit area. So I could take a table and take a little cube of the table and calculate what the area density is, which would be the mass of that dA, so mass per unit area. Generally speaking, when you have a linear mass density, we'll use the symbol lambda. For the area, we'll use sigma, and for the volume, we'll use rho. Just in general, it's very important to take certain symbols and use them for many different things in physics to create as much general confusion as we can do. And so you will find that's certainly true here. Lambda is a symbol for wavelength, it's a linear mass density, it's a linear charge density, sigma, etc. So these are used for lots of different things, unfortunately. So sometimes it's by context, you have to keep it straight. The pain of that will become apparent to you in Physics 114 as you begin to see the other ways in which these are used. So in this problem, it is given to you that the linear mass density of this bat is this weird function. Okay? It is a function of x, and it is a constant times this mathematical function. Let's think about it for a moment. If x is equal to 0, this term is 0, and I tell you that there is a linear mass density at this point which is equal to lambda 0. As you go out in x, this term grows up to the point where x is equal to L, which is the length of the bat, in which case 1 plus L squared over L squared is 1. This factor becomes 2. And so when you get to this point, the linear mass density has grown to 2 times lambda 0. So it increases in this way from this point up to that point, from lambda 0 up to 2 lambda 0. So it's not a perfect model. If you're into baseball, obviously you have a little bit more mass here than you do here. And this may not really be growing in this particular way. But it's not crazy in the sense that you see that it starts with smaller mass here per unit length and gets to be bigger over here if I were to cut the bat in pieces. You okay with that? All right. So that's a given. That is the linear mass density. That's basically the function that describes what we were saying was rho in our earlier expression. So we now want to calculate the center of mass of this thing. Roughly, where do you think it might be? If you had to guess. How would you mentally figure that out?
I guess it would be a little difficult to the
Okay, so a little bit off to the right-hand side, basically, because you have more weight over there. So a way to think about it is simply, if your bat is here, where would you put your hand if you were going to try to balance the bat? That would be the center of mass. That's sort of the intuition you have, or should have. Okay, so here's our definition, and now we just have to sort of do it. And the way that you do it is you imagine at some arbitrary point along this volume or along this length, we take a little dx and we look at its mass and we say it has a little dm. And when we have a little dm, regardless of the fact that this thing is moving, we know how the mass changes with length. So I know that the mass I have here, dm, is going to be equal to this function, mass per unit length, times the length over which I'm talking, which is dx. Okay? And I have to have a little mass and a little dx because this thing is changing, so I have to have a very limited length so that basically this linear mass density isn't changing over that length. Under those circumstances, I know how to write this. Okay? I know that dm is going to be that function, that density, times the length. So here we go. And I want to integrate from this point all the way to that point, summing up all the little dms weighted by x. So I integrate over the variable x. You might say, but this integral is over m. That's true, but I don't know anything about m. What I know is about the length of this thing, and I know how the mass changes with length. So the variable I want to integrate over is the dx. And I want to integrate from 0 out to L. And so I take this quantity, I rewrite the dm in terms of the variable that I can actually do something with. So I have lambda dx. The bottom here is also a lambda dx, because that's the dm. In this case, I have to do this integral because I haven't been given the mass of the bat. So I don't know what it is. So if I take the top part, I have written, the denominator, so that's the bottom part, it's just the integral over dm, which was this integral, which I wrote down. I then can put in the function of what lambda x is, and then the sum of the integral, the integral of the sum is the sum of the integrals, so I divide that up into the two integrals, okay? This is a constant, it pulls out, the integral of dx is just x. Evaluated between L and 0. So here's the lambda pulled out. The integral of this is x. I evaluate it between L and 0. So that this term would be lambda times L minus lambda times 0. So that's my lambda 0 times L. So that's from this piece. The second term here, I integrate the x squared. The lambda 0 and the L squared both pull out. Okay? Because they're constant. I integrate the x squared. The integral of that is x cubed over 3. If you don't know that, it will be on your formula sheet, but I think you should know that. So the integral of x squared is x cubed over 3. Here's the x cubed over 3. I pulled out the lambda 0. I pulled out the L squared because they're constant. I evaluate this between the limits of L and 0. So this becomes lambda L cubed over 3 L squared, which is going to be lambda L over 3, which is this term, minus 0. So now I have these two things, and I add them together, and I get 4/3 lambda 0 times L. I've just calculated a mass, at least so I think, so I better have mass units. Lambda 0 here is a linear mass length. So it is kilograms per meter. I multiply that by a length in meters, I have kilograms, so I have a mass. Okay? You should always, always, always check your units, because if, for example, you screw up this integral and you have an extra power of x here, you'll have some extra something here, and it will screw up your units. So you can really check to make sure that you've got the right thing. Okay, so recall that the top of the center mass integral we want to do is the integral of x times dm, which becomes the integral of x lambda dx. So here's the lambda function times x dx. I integrate again along the length of the bath, okay? And when I do, again, I get the two terms. In this case, the integral is x squared over 2. In this case, it's x to the fourth over 4. I evaluate it between the limits of 0 and L. So here's the x squared over 2. Here's the x fourth over 4th. The constants pull out just like they did. When I now evaluate between these limits, I get these two terms. This one is from the first. I have the L squared lambda 0 over 2. This one is from the second, where I have L to the 4th over L squared gives me the L squared, and I have the lambda 0, and I have the 4th. I then can add these two together, and I get 3/4 lambda 0 L squared. So the denominator is this. So now I can look for the center of mass, which is going to be the numerator, divided by the numerator, which I did second ago, divided by the denominator. So here's the numerator, here's the denominator, and you end up with 9/16 L. Halfway from 0 to 1 is going to be 8/16 L. So what we find is the center of mass is a little bit to the right, as per expectation, right, of L. And you should think about what you're doing, because it's a baseball bat, so if it ended up left, then you know you screwed something up, because that would make no sense. You happy? I can tell that most of you cannot wait to do your very own problem. So, any questions? All right. Alright, so we're going to leave center mass coordinates in a second, but I wanted to at least make one point for you as to partly why they're so useful. Remember that when we started center mass coordinates, we were looking at this ball that basically crumbled, which I thought about. And from momentum conservation, if you think of this as the initial state and this is the final state, from momentum conservation, we know that the mass of this thing times the velocity of what we call the center of mass, or times its velocity, is going to be equal to the mass of each of these little objects times their velocity with a vector sum. Okay? So that's by definition what we mean by momentum conservation. When we introduced it, we started here and then worked backwards to there. This is what we call the center of mass coordinate system. It's basically the center, it is the position of where this thing would be if it hadn't been broken apart. It's the intuition you can have. Let's now move down the other way. If we take the time derivative of this function, then we get the mass times the acceleration of the center of mass, which is sort of some theoretical construct when you have all these pieces. Right? It's a little bit strange to think about it. But if I take the derivative of this side, I now get the little masses individually times their vector accelerations for each little individual piece. Well, by definition, this is the mass times, I'm sorry, this is equal to the force on the center of mass. And over here, I have the net forces, the vector forces, on each individual little piece. And these are vector sums. So over on this side, it's the sum of all forces that are on the center of mass itself. And over here, I have the sum of each force of the forces on each of the individual pieces. Okay? Now, I want to look at each of these sums And I want to break it into two different pieces. One is those forces that are from external things, like gravity, if this were a ball flying and broken to pieces, okay? So this force, I want to break into those forces that come from external sources, that's what EXT means, on mass one, plus forces that come from internal pieces, that is, forces on this object, you know, whatever mass one is, due to all the other little pieces. So you can imagine if they're all very massive, they all have gravity, so they'll have gravity interacting with each other, and then you may have some big external gravitational force as well. Okay? So this is the external piece, and this would be the internal piece. Here you have the same thing. You have the external force on mass 2, and then you have internal pieces. Now, I've truncated the internal pieces because in principle, mass 1 could have a force on it from all the other little internal pieces. I mean, I don't know what it is. But let's only consider the internal force between masses 1 and 2 for the moment. If we do that, then here are the pieces that are flying along. They may have a force between each other. So there might be gravitational attraction, for example, between mass 1 and mass 2. So this force would represent the force of this mass on mass 1. This force would represent the force of mass 1 on mass 2. So that's where the 2, 1 and the 1, 2 come. Okay? You know, because this one's acting on that one's acting on this one. You have an action-reaction pair, as per Newton's third law. So F21 is equal and opposite in direction from F12, because they're an action-reaction pair. You have some external force on each of these. It could be different individually. So what that means is that if I only consider the internal forces of 1 and 2, then the force on this puppy is going to be the external force on it plus the force of 2 on 1. And on this one, it's going to be the external force on 2 plus the force of 1 on 2, which is negative of 2, 1, equal and opposite direction, which means the internal force of 1 on 2 and 2 on 1 cancel out. And that's going to be true for all internal forces for the system that we're considering. So what that means is that this sum, which in principle is very complex because you have all these pieces that could be interacting with one another, becomes very simple. It becomes just the sum of the external forces. You can like think of it like a box or something, right? It just has whatever forces are coming on it from outside. And all this internal crap just goes to zero. So this is one of the things that sort of comes out of this thinking that's very nice. Very often you don't need to worry about what's going on internally, which can be very complex and unknown, but you only have to worry about whatever the external force is on the center of mass as a whole. Okay? Just think what a stellar day. Did an integral, and now we got internal forces that go away. All right. Any questions? Okay. I happen to have a clean set of slides on these, so I'm going to take advantage of that and use them. I know I go fast, but these will be posted every weekend, so you can sort of grab them. So the next thing I want to do is to start looking at things with rotation. Okay, we've looked at the linear world. Everything we've been doing has been linear, except for a little bit with circular motion. So now we're going to go sort of crazy with circular motion. And circular motion, I think, is very opaque initially. The way to make it make sense is to leverage what you know about linear motion and think about what it means as you move into sort of a rotational system. And the way to think about that is there's a very particular relationship between the linear world and the rotational world. And you've seen it, I think, many times. If you look as you go around a circle, the arc length is related to the radius and the angle that you sweep out by this equation. Right? Where S is the arc length that you go, R is the radius where you are, where you're taking that arc length, and theta is the angle through which you sweep. Okay? So hopefully you've seen that many, many times. One warning, that's going to bite you. It bites me all the time. You note that this equation works when theta is in radian units. Right? That's sort of how radian units are defined, if you want to think about it that way. So what that means is when you are doing rotational problems, you're going to need to make sure when you're calculating angles that you're in radian units. And then you go to the next problem and you're doing some angle in projectile motion and you've got 2 degrees, you need to make sure that you're in degrees. Okay? So you're going to have to learn to keep your eye on what units that you're thinking and in particular what units your calculator is saying so that when you evaluate something, you've got it in the right units. So, sort of painful. Okay, so here is the basic fundamental relationship between arc length, radius, and angle. So you can imagine having some random shaped body like this, which is rotating about this point. So if you want to imagine, you know, some board which is sort of this shape, which has been nailed to the wall loosely so that it can rotate about that nail. And there's the nail. So we're going to put the axis of rotation, and we're only going to worry about this plane for now. We're going to put the axis of rotation centered at the origin of that thing. And as this extended body rotates, you can imagine some little differential mass rotates through an angle. This entire body rotates through the same angle. And if you pick a particular point, then you have established what R is, you also get an arc length. Okay? So at a certain radius, you have an arc length. But notice that the arc length that you rotate through here is different from the arc length you rotate there from there. Right? As you move, as I do this, my fingertips rotate through much more distance than my elbow does. Right? So it is that radial scaling that you have to keep in mind with rotational motion. It is the thing that relates the linear to the angular world. Here's our relationship. Let us say that at a fixed radius, I want to understand how things work. So that would mean, for example, if I rotate through a little d theta at a fixed r, then I also rotate along a differential arc length ds. And that arc length is related to that angle through which you go by this equation, which, if I'm in the form of differentials, it says ds is equal to r d theta. Let us say that this thing is moving as a function of time, so I can now look over that differential piece. I can take the derivative with respect to time. When I do that, this is a linear distance. Even though it's curved, it is a linear thing, right? Because you're looking at arc length. That's a line, even though it looks curved. It's a linear distance divided by time, so this is the linear velocity of the object at that radius, tangential to the rotation. Right? So if it's a wheel rotating, you're looking at a point on the edge of the wheel and you're asking what is the instantaneous linear velocity of the point on that outer edge of the wheel. That would be what this is. That is tangential linear velocity. You're used to that. Okay? It is no different from what you've already dealt with, in a sense, except it's tangential everywhere along the motion, so you just have to keep that in mind. This is R, which we're saying is fixed. D theta, the derivative with respect to time. This is how much angle you sweep through per unit time. So this is a different sort of velocity. It's like, we call it the angular velocity. So that would be the, whereas theta is the measure of linear, where theta is the angular analog to arc length, which is in the linear world, theta is in the rotational world. Here, tangential velocity is the linear thing, and the angular velocity is what you deal with when you're dealing with rotational motion. It is nothing more than the linear velocity divided by the radius at which you're determining. Okay? The reason we work in theta, if you think about it, is every point on this mass rotates with the same angular velocity. Right? This piece goes around the circle in the same amount of time this piece goes around the circle. So that they both sweep through the same angle per unit time. But if you think about it, something here goes a short distance, something here goes a big distance, so the linear velocity of those points is very different. Okay? If I'm talking too much physics-ese, sorry, let me sort of try to bring it down to earth a little bit. You go out, you get stuck by your so-called friends at the bar, and you're walking home, and you run into some dude who's got a baseball bat who's about to take your head off. Would you rather get hit with the end of the bat, or would you rather run toward him and get hit with the short end of the bat? Go toward him. Unless you can truly get away. Obviously, you want to duck and run. If you can, get missed altogether. But if you're going to get hit, you want to get hit where he has at small r. Because if you're hit at small r, it's not going fast. The linear velocity is small when it hits you. Okay? But the end of the bat, that's going really fast. Right? Take the derivative again, and we're now dealing with acceleration. This is the second derivative of the spatial part, the linear part. So this is the tangential acceleration of a point at that radius, right? Which could be slowing down, could be speeding up, I don't know, but then you have an acceleration at that point. And so that's what this represents. Take the second derivative of this, you get that. It's basically the derivative of, we call angular velocity, by the way, omega, and units are in radians per second. So we take the derivative of omega, we have what is, we call the angular acceleration in radians per second squared. So it's exactly analogous to the linear acceleration that you're used to seeing, which is distance linear you go, meters, per second squared. Now we're doing angle you sweep through per second squared. So a way to think about it is if you have a wheel and it is speeding up, then you will have an angular acceleration. It could be slowing down, you'll also have an angular acceleration. And we'll have to worry about how we know when it's speeding up or slowing down in terms of the algebraic sign and stuff like that, but we'll get there. Okay, any questions about that? Okay, so these are the things to keep in mind. I guess the one thing I didn't say is the angular acceleration, we use the symbol alpha instead of the Roman letter A. Okay? So we use Greek letters over here for the angular variables, theta, omega, and alpha. You can write these on your sheet. I will tell you that where I'm concerned, if you ask me some question in my office or outside that has anything to do with angular acceleration or anything to do with angular variables, and I'm helping you work it out. If you watch, you will find me write down S equals R theta, or say S equals R theta to myself, because that's the only way I would keep it straight. That's the one thing I remember, is S is equal to R theta. I never remember these two. So I always start with this and then take derivatives to figure out which side the R is on, basically. So you can do it however you want. You'll be using these things a lot, but you probably want to put them on your informant sheet just to make sure they're right. To make sure they're right, if you do that, I have had the student come to me and they screwed up every rotational problem because they put the R's on the wrong side. And, you know, but I put it wrong on my formula sheet. Oh, well. Okay, so be careful. Anyway, so we went through, on the linear side, stuff that you have seen long ago. We defined the velocity as the derivative, linear derivative, with respect to time, of dx over dt. So we take the dt and move it over. We have this. Now we can integrate both sides, which we did way back when. And we got this equation, if you recall. So the integral of dx is just x evaluated between where you end up minus where you start, right? So that's x minus x0. And this is the integral of v dt. And in order to do this integral, I have to tell you something about v, which might be varying in some complicated way. I don't know. But remember that when we saw this about the second day or third day of class, we looked at this equation and we said this is absolutely general. Okay, and it is always true. And that's true. It comes from the definition of the linear velocity. We do exactly the same thing in the rotational world. We start with the definition of the rotational velocity, the angular velocity, omega. And it is d theta over dt. We then move the dt over, and we integrate on each side. So the integral of d theta is just the difference between where you start and where you end up. So it's theta minus theta 0. And that's equal to the integral of omega dt. When you do these things, theta, in this world, theta might be more than a few degrees, okay? Theta might be 18 kajillion degrees, because the wheel might rotate through 360 degrees, 720, etc., etc. So you might be asked an equation to figure out, for example, here's a wheel and there's some sort of a force on it which may be slowing it down. How much angle does it spin through before it stops? And so it's not just a 0 to 360 or a 0 to 2 pi sort of thing. At any rate, this equation then is completely analogous to this one, but this one is in the angular world. And it is also always true because it follows directly from the definition of angular velocity. Okay? So now we're going to do exactly what we did in the linear world, where we now look at this expression, which is how we define alpha. It's d omega dt. We pull the dt over, we integrate, and we get omega minus omega 0 is equal to integral of alpha dt. This is exactly like what we did in linear world, where we ended up with b minus b 0 is the integral of a dt, which you saw on the third day of class. Okay, so it's exactly the same thing. Again, this follows directly from the definition, so this is always true. So in the linear world, what we did at that point is we said, well, why don't we make the approximation that the acceleration is constant? Maybe we have that. As you know now, that's really the approximation that you have a constant force on the mass that's moving. So now I want to do the same thing here. What I'd like to do is to assume that alpha is constant. So we have a constant angular acceleration. The way to think about it is if I've got a wheel spinning, the angular velocity is being reduced. The rate at which it is slowing down is constant. Okay? Here's my expression. If alpha is constant, I can pull it out of the integral. And then this integral becomes just t minus t zero. So I have omega minus omega zero is alpha t minus t zero. I regroup it. Omega is equal to omega zero plus alpha t, which is very exactly like v is equal to v zero plus at, which you see. This is sort of the formal way to do it. Another way to think through it is I know I have a linear equation here. I can translate each of these variables into their angular variables. So remember that v is equal to r omega. So this v becomes r omega. This v0 becomes r omega 0, where that's the starting omega. Alpha becomes r alpha. A becomes r alpha. So I can rewrite it like so. The r's all cancel out, and I'm left with the same equation. Okay? So basically, I can go through that for the other three constant acceleration equations. So the derivation is exactly like what we did on the third day of class, or fourth day of class, whenever it was. But you can also simply take each of these, put in their angular variables, and cancel out r, and you find that you get the angular constant angular acceleration equations. So here are four equations that in a world where something is rotating, these have the kind of usefulness to you that the constant acceleration equations did in the linear world where you have constant A. So, in fact, you will find the majority of your problems will be the kinds of problems where you'll be doing things with these equations. But just like in the linear case, always, always, always make sure that you are in the limit where alpha, that its angular acceleration, is constant, because it's only under those circumstances these equations are true. Okay? Alright, so here's an example. I have some disk that is rotating. I'm going to give you a sense of the rotation by here, the axis is going through here, the back side is over there. Think of this as a disk perpendicular that is rotating, and I'm playing perpendicular to the board. The front side relative to you is right here, and the sense of rotation is like that. Okay? And I'm going to tell you that it has an initial angular velocity, which is 120 radians per second. So does that make sense or not? Remember that if I went 2 pi per second, then I would rotate a single time per second. 2 pi is about 6.3 or something. Radians, right? So this is pretty fast. It's going very fast, but still, sometimes you may want to think about what you mean in terms of numbers of rotation or something. But at any rate, it is initially rotating with this. We say that it slows down with a constant angular acceleration of 4 radians per second squared. The minute you see this, you know that your 4 constant angular acceleration equations work. So if I take this and say how much time elapses before the disk stops rotating, if you can use your constant alpha equations, then you go back, you look at them, and you pick out the one which basically works, which is omega is equal to omega 0 plus alpha t. Omega, you know, is 0 because it stops rotating. Okay. Omega 0 is 120. And now we have to worry a bit about the sign. Okay, in the linear world, remember the sign was sort of obvious. In this case, you're going to have some sense of what's going on and think about what the signs are. If it says that it is slowing down, then you know that alpha is going to reduce the omega, because that's what you mean by slowing down. So that means alpha has to be negative. Okay? If I said speeding up, then you know it's going to have to make omega bigger, and alpha would be positive. So it slows down, and this problem, we say, before it stops rotating, if the force, if the angular force, whatever that is, continues to operate on it, it will stop and begin rotating the other way. So it's exactly analogous to, I have a ball, I throw it in the air, it has this positive velocity that it gets smaller and smaller and smaller, zero, and then it starts growing in the other direction. In this case, the wheel is spinning very fast, it slows down because of that alpha to a stop, and then it will start rotating and speeding up the other way. That's what the negative alpha will do to you. In this problem, you don't have to worry about it going the other way because basically the problem stops when it's zero. So if a linear problem, it would be how far does it rise before it stops or something. You okay? All right. It turns out all your intuition from the linear world works fine in these problems. They just take a little bit of getting used to, the whole angular thing and alpha and all that. So it is really important that you spend time and do problems and get used to it. But as opaque as it may sort of feel at first, trust me, it's really not bad at all once you sort of, in your mind, begin to be able to move between the linear and the rotational stuff. It's not so bad. Okay? Any questions? All right. So, we have talked about the linear... the rotational kinematic variables. Remember, in the linear, the variables we use would be position, velocity, acceleration, and time. In the rotational world, the rotational analogs are angle in radians, angular velocity, angular acceleration, and time. Okay? So now we have to worry a little bit about what are the other variables that you have to deal with in the rotational world. So, the kinds of things that we have found useful in the linear world are things like forces, masses, momenta, and now we have to sort of figure out what are the rotational analogs of all of those things. And this actually is where life starts to get complicated for us a little bit. Because to try to relate the linear world to the angular world for things like forces and masses and momenta, it gets a little bit complicated because of the radial scaling a little bit. Okay, so I said that a little bit too much in a physics way. How many of you have entered Wilson Commons down by the doors that go off to the gym? Okay? Now, I'm sure most of you have. Now, tell the truth. I want you to raise your hand if, in doing so, you have hit the wrong side of the door and damn near broke your nose, and then looked around, make sure nobody was looking, and then went to the other side of the door and opened it, right? How many of you have done that? Come on. I do it at least once a week. Right? In the physics world, it's a little bit weird. Because when you hit the door, you're hitting it with the same force. In the 50% of the time that you hit the wrong side of the door, it doesn't open. And in the 50% of the time you hit the right side of the door, it does open very nicely. So the same force has a different rotational effect depending on where it's applied relative to the axis of rotation. Okay? So I guess I already... Sometimes when I introduce this, I ask for some petite female and a football player to come up here, and I ask the petite female to open the door. And then I ask the football player to open the door, but I tell him he has to apply his force right here. Right? It's the same thing. I can't really open the door here. But if I do that here, it opens just fine. Okay? So, where the force is applied makes a difference. There is a difference between angular force and linear force. What do I mean when I say linear force? The way to think about that is if a body is acted on by that linear force, it gives an acceleration in that direction. Okay? Which is inversely proportional to mass. What do I mean when I talk about angular force? It's the same thing. What I'm saying is an angular force is what gives me an alpha in that direction. If you open a door, what you're doing is you're giving it an angular velocity. You're making a change in its angular velocity from zero to whatever you need to have it can rotate like that. Okay? So you're applying a force to get the alpha. That's basically what makes the door open.
So what do we figure out? Well, there are a couple of other effects that come into play that make it complicated.
If the door is a light screen door, it's easy to open. If it's a big, honking, heavy, thick wooden door, then I have to push harder in order to get it to open. So, in fact, it cares what the mass is, just like you have in the linear world. Okay? But again, it's a little bit more complex. Because if I have just a wooden rod, okay, I can pretty much, if I have my finger, well, pretend I can actually balance it, I can literally spin it pretty trivially, okay? I don't have to push it hard. But if I take that same mass and I now make a big barbell out of it, it's going to be harder for me to actually make it rotate. So, what I'm trying to do is build on your intuition of just living in the regular world. You actually already know all this stuff, but it's complicated. So what that means is that it matters how the mass is distributed. So where the force is applied matters, how much mass is there matters, and how the mass is distributed relative to the axis of rotation matters. Now to make matters even worse, how you apply the force matters. I can take a force and I can apply it along a line that is perpendicular to the axis, to the line that goes to the axis. So I have, here's my axis of rotation like so. The line that goes out to the end of the door is like this. If I apply the force perpendicular to that, I get the door to open. If I apply the same force at the same point, but I apply it along that line, I can't really get the door open. All I'm doing is pulling on the whatever's holding the door. It doesn't cause a rotation. So, where you apply the force relative to the axis, how much mass is there, what is the distribution of the mass, and what is the direction of the application of the force are all important. All right, when we start talking about a rotational force. So that makes life sort of complicated. So what I'd like to do is just begin thinking through all those pieces. Linear force, F equals ma. What have we learned about the force if we don't worry about all the stuff I just talked about? One of the things we learn is that the action that happens with the force, the reaction to that force, depends on where the force is located. And basically, the further away from the axis where that force acts, the easier it is for things, for you to get things to rotate. So that's sort of the thinking of putting an R here, if you will. Okay? On this side, if I put this R here, A converts to R alpha. I now put another R, so I put an R on each side. This one I hope just sort of made sense a little bit, okay? Maybe the R squared, R cubed, I don't know, but we know that it grows, we know that the action of the force should grow with R, so this would be the simplest case. But let me just multiply each side by R, then I get this combination of things. Here's my angular acceleration. I want to group the mass with R here. I'll call this sort of my angular mass. And this I'll call my angular force, if you will. Okay? And instead of using words angular force, we define that as tau, and we call it the torque. This is a measure of angular mass. What the R is here is to think of it as, for every little bit of mass that you're rotating, this is the radius where that little bit of mass happens to be. So if the mass is located far away from the axis, then it is harder to make the thing rotate. If the mass is big, it is harder to make it rotate. So this R piece here is what gives you sort of this, that weird scaling. It's what tells you you can or can't rotate things easily. This weird quantity, which is basically the mass-weighted square, position squared mass sum, if you want to think that, sort of this weird thing we call the moment of inertia. So something with a big moment of inertia, you have to apply a big angular force or torque in order to get a big alpha. So this is equal to F, this is F equals ma in the angular world. Angular mass is called moment of inertia, angular force is called torque, and angular acceleration we've seen. And your intuition can be the same in the sense that for me to get a big alpha, that is to speed up the rotation or make it rotate from zero to something, I have to apply a bigger force. If it has a large moment of inertia, which could get by having a large mass, or it could get by having that mass distributed farther and farther away from the axis of rotation, then for a given angular force, I get less angular acceleration. You okay with that? Okay, so now I want to talk a moment about this moment of inertia. It has to be a bit more formal. Here's some body, and it's rotating about a particular point. This thing is a solid thing, so it rotates as a rigid body. Here's my equation. Torque is equal to I times alpha. I multiply H by R, if you want to think about it. So for a given little bit of mass, I know that the differential force that I need on that little piece basically goes as that mass times its radius squared, if you want to think about it that way. So if I want to calculate this piece, okay? And remember that what it says is that the degree to which that mass resists the angular acceleration depends on the size of the mass and how far away it is from the axis in a squared sense. So this is the piece I want to do. And if I go to a continuous body, which is what we normally have, I can think of this as an infinite sum of little masses, each of which, if I want to calculate the moment of inertia of each of these individual little pieces, it goes as this mr squared, where this is that little mass, and this would be its radius squared. Excuse me. So I can have a differential moment of inertia of this piece, which I'll call di, which is equal to its radius, r squared, times however much mass I have. And now to get to total moment of inertia, I integrate over that entire volume, whatever it is. So the total moment of inertia is by summing up all the little moments of inertia. And then on the right-hand side, in order to evaluate, I basically have to integrate over whatever this volume is, this quantity r squared dm. dm, remember, might vary, as we have with our baseball bat, the amount of mass you got for each little bit away from the... If I swing that baseball bat that we calculated a while ago, every little bit of mass is a distance, it's a different distance from me, and the density was changing. So this basically becomes rho dv, as we've done earlier. So you integrate over the whole volume, this r squared dm. So this depends on what it is that's rotating. It depends on how it's shaped and the mass distribution. Okay? So, yes, you're going to probably calculate one or two of these. But much of the time, you can just look it up. So, you can calculate the moment of inertia for different shapes. And when you do, for example, if I have a solid hoop, a solid wheel, where it's empty in here, and it's rotating about this point, so it's like a hula hoop, if you will, has radius r, when you calculate that integral, you'll find that you get the mass of the thing times this big r squared. Which, interestingly enough, would be the same thing you would get if you had all the mass at a point going along that same circle. But in a sense, from the angular world, all the mass at a point going around the circle is really very similar to the hoop having a uniform distribution around the circle. It's sort of the same thing. So this might not be a hoop surprise. If you take a solid cylinder of radius r, uniform density of mass m, and you calculate that integral that we did a moment ago, then you'll get 1/2 mr squared. It's different. And if you take that same mass and you try to rotate it, you'll find it's different. So these different shapes sort of have this different angular mass. They have different moments of inertia. So you may need to know how to calculate one of these things, and you'll get a little practice with that. But in general, either it will be given to you for most problems, or you'll have a table, basically. So it's given to you in one form or another. And it matters sort of where the axis of the shape and where the axis of rotation is. So you'll have some table, and sorry I didn't reproduce super well. Here's the one that we just said. Here's a different one where this hula hoop has a big thickness, so it's more like a thick pipe that's rotating, and it has an inner radius and an outer radius, and so you get a different equation. Here's the one we just said, the sort of cylinder that is rotating about the symmetry axis of the cylinder. Then it has a 1/2 mr squared. If I were to take that same cylinder of length, a certain length, L, and now, it's here, if I now put an axis through it this way and rotate it like that, then I get a different moment of inertia. If I have a thin rod where basically you only really need to worry about the length, it would have a certain moment of inertia. Spheres have different moments of inertia. So some of this may make sense. I mean, imagine I have this thin rod and I spin it around the center as opposed to spinning it about the end. Which case would be easier to spin?
mass that's further away is harder to make move. So if I'm spinning about the center, you have the same mass, but it's distributed on average much closer to the central axis. If I try to spin it about the end, so instead of this, right, I do this, it's much harder to spin because I now have a lot of mass that's much further away. And its resistance to the angular acceleration grows as the square of that radius. So you might expect the moment of inertia for the thing about this axis to be bigger than it is about the center axis. Here's the center axis. This goes as 1/12 times the mass times the length squared. Here it is about the end. It goes as 1/3 times the mass times the length squared. So it's four times smaller. Okay? We have to worry about energy. So we have 1/2 mv squared in the linear world. If we imagine what is the kinetic energy of a rotating mass, well, remember that if I have a big ball here that's rotating about this axis, I have pieces that are very close to that axis are not rotating very fast. The pieces out here that have to go through a much bigger distance in the same time are moving very fast. So I can try to sum up over all those little pieces. Here's a little vm. I can say that its kinetic energy will be 1/2 times its mass times its velocity. That velocity scales with radius. V is equal to r omega. So I can convert that v squared into r omega squared. And remember, this weird combination, mr squared, for that given piece, is what we've defined as the moment of inertia. This is maybe not a formal proof, but it just to try to make you feel comfortable with it. So this piece becomes I, this piece becomes omega, and you end up with the kinetic energy being an exact analog to the linear kinetic energy. Instead of 1/2 mv squared, we have 1/2 I omega squared. I being the angular mass, omega being the angular velocity. So it's sort of easy to remember that way. Okay, so let's suppose I have two wheels. They have exactly the same mass. In one case, it's a wooden wheel with most of the mass sort of a metal rim. So it has much of its mass, that large radius. In another case, I have a wooden thing, same radius, roughly the same mass, but now I have a metal plug here so that much of its mass is at the center. Okay? So the top one is represented by this wheel, the bottom one by this wheel. So if that's the case, we say that they have the same mass, same radius, different mass distributions. Which one is going to win if I put them on an inclined plane and release them from rest side by side? Which one is going to make it to the bottom of the inclined plane first? Is it going to be number one, number two, or are they both going to reach the bottom at the same time? Think about it for just a moment. Who thinks it will be number one? Who thinks it will be number two? Okay, so I saw something like a 50-50 split between those. Who thinks it's number two? They both get there at the same time. Okay, nobody thinks that. All right. Hey, drum roll. Okay, so I have the top one farthest from you and the bottom one closest to you. Which one? Number two got there first. Number one did not. Why?
rebellious and they come in towards the masses.
Oh, we are so going to get there. Didn't want to go there quite yet. I have the same change in energy, right? Because I have the same MGH. That has to be converted to kinetic energy. So a way to think about it is that kinetic energy takes the form of its 1/2 mv squared plus this 1/2 I omega squared as it's rotating. In other words, I take the same energy and some of it goes into the linear piece, but some of it goes into the energy of rotation of this thing. The energy of rotation of this thing depends on its moment of inertia. To get the one with the mass further out, because the mass is further out, has a big moment of inertia, it is harder to get it to rotate. That is, for a given omega, it has more energy. If I have more energy to get this thing rotating, then I have less energy to go into the velocity, if you want to think of it that way. So, for the same energy change, it takes less energy to get this puppy to rotate than it does this. Okay? And so that's why this thing is going to end up going faster, because there's, for the same energy, I can get it to. Did that make any sense? Can't tell. Okay. So let's try a different one. I have here a block of wood, which has a mass of 500 grams or something. Yeah. And then I have the same size, same shape, a block of copper. A little bit heavier. Okay. Same question. Let's say the top one looks like the copper. We'll call the top one copper and the bottom one. So number one was the copper. Number two is this one. How many of you think this one will get to the bottom first? How many of you think this one will get to the bottom first? How many of you think they'll both get there at the same time? All right. Ready? That didn't happen, did it? But then the accuracy of my letting things go, it's a dead heat. Think about that one. We'll come back and talk about it next time. Okay. See ya.